I just have a few things to say. Thank you for coming in. But it's so beautiful outside, but it's going to be even more beautiful inside. You're in for a really interesting and mysterious phenomenon. Anyway, John Zada is a writer and photographer with an adventure, or rather an interest in adventure travel and the far-flung regions of the world. He's worked in over 24 countries and spent years as a journalist in the Middle East. His work has appeared in Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, CBC, Al Jazeera, the BBC, and more. It's a long list, and I cut it all down. I just said a few things. As I said, this is going to be a really interesting talk because it's such a fascinating, really, really fascinating book. Lots of mysterious things going on, right? Please welcome John Zada.
Thanks for coming. I'm a writer, photographer, journalist from Toronto, of all places. I've spent the last, I would say, 6 years or so working on this book, which is essentially a work of narrative nonfiction in which I travel throughout much of the central and the north coast of British Columbia, investigating Sasquatch reports in an attempt to, I guess, better understand the phenomenon, not just for myself, but in a kind of in a wider sense, and put it in a context of you know, human belief and perception and everything. So, I guess I want to first ask how many of you are familiar with the Bigfoot Sasquatch phenomenon, like above and beyond just the general kind of understanding that there are these alleged man-ape kind of creatures around. Okay, one over there. And perhaps this is a similar question, but does anyone here know anyone who's claimed to have seen one? Or, oh yeah, okay. Yeah? Okay, maybe we can talk a little bit about that after. But there are reports that come from the Interlake region just north of here. So it's not just a BC or a West Coast thing. So I want to first just tell you a bit about the region that I traveled in. It's an area known as the Great Bear Rainforest, as you see up here on the slide. And it is essentially known as, or billed as, the largest intact coastal temperate rainforest in the world. It's an ecosystem that is, you know, essentially pristine and unviolated. I mean, there's a little bit of logging on the north and the southern end, but I mean, as far as forest and wilderness regions goes, it's this really, really beautiful, intact place where you've got like 700,000-800,000 year old trees, grizzly bears, wolves, all manner of flora and fauna, you know, interacting or being interdependent with the ocean, and whales and ocean life and marine life. I mean, when you go there, it is, you know, truly, truly an incredible, incredible place. And I'll go back to that strange picture afterwards. That's for the later part of the presentation. So that's a snapshot of the topography and the geography there. This is an, you know, an ocean channel. I mean, it may look like a large lake or whatever, but this is actually the ocean extending into the coast mountains. And you have a couple of really small towns, as you saw on the previous slide, Bella Bella, Bella Coola, these little communities that are generally indigenous. And so the story sort of begins, I'll tell you why sort of after, in 2012, when I got sent here to work on an assignment for a magazine. Travel assignment. I do adventure writing, and you know, my intention was to basically write a long feature about this, you know, up and coming adventure destination, and it had just recently garnered a bit of protection because it is a protectorate to some degree, but when I got there, you know, strangely enough or interestingly enough, my trip coincided with a rash of reports in all the communities of these animals, these creatures, these man apes, if you want to call them that. And so, I mean, from the moment that I arrived, I was inundated with all of these anecdotes and tales of people having, you know, seen these creatures. And, you know, in Bella Bella, it was at a youth camp. There's a cultural Heltsik First Nation camp down there called Kwe, where they take the kids and they teach them, you know, their language and their culture. But and it's in a very, very remote part of the mainland coast in a watershed which I think has been described as perhaps the most intact watershed in North America even. So, I mean, you could imagine how remote. And so they've had visitations in the night of these things. They come and they, like, bang on cabins. And so there's all these stories related to that. And then when I continued up to a town called Klemtu, I'm just going to jump ahead here. That's Bella Bella right there. And the camp is just further down the coast. Klemtu, the same thing. There's a reservoir up above the town where they get their drinking water, and people who go up there claim to see these giant footprints, and it's basically a commonplace thing. So I was traveling all over the place, and by the end of the 2 weeks, after hearing all of these stories, I didn't really have so much information or interview material or anything on, like, travel or adventure or whatnot. And it basically, I left there with loads and loads and loads of material about Sasquatch. And so I resolved to, you know, go back to the region because I fell in love with the place and I saw the potential for a book, essentially. So I'm just going to show you. It's a little bit sort of blurry just because of the screen and the computer, but I mean, this gives you an idea of just how, if you're familiar with forest environments, I mean, it's just stunning, basically. It's almost like out of Lord of the Rings, kind of that sort of, you know, this little creek system that goes into the mountains up towards the lake. So I ended my trip in Bella Coola, and I'm going to come back to this when I do my reading at the end. Bella Coola is a Newhawk First Nation community, and you can see just by the edge of the inlet there, there's the town, and then there's a little community just a few miles up. There's a little clearing there by the other valley entrance. This area here is considered to be really one of the main hot spots for Sasquatch and Bigfoot. If not in British Columbia, then, you know, perhaps in the Pacific Northwest. And it's the stories that I heard here in particularly that drew me back. And so I'll be coming back to the whole Bella Coola connection with my reading. So to back up a little bit, I have a childhood fascination with the Sasquatch. So that's my admission sort of from the top. So the trip going out there in 2012... I mean, I knew that there was Bigfoot there. I didn't really go there looking for it, but I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, and that was a time of, you know, very, very, very intense cultural references to Sasquatch in the pop culture. So I'm sure some of you will remember, you know, TV shows like The $6 Million Man, The Bionic Man, and if any of you don't know what that is, you could do a kind of YouTube search, and there's like a few episodes where Steve Austin, the cyborg main character, like fights the Sasquatch, and it's like he rips its arm off and it turns out to be a robot. But you know, as a kid, when you watch this stuff, you kind of get a little bit freaked out and a bit sort of traumatized by it, and you're just like, wow, like there are these creatures, are they for real? And so I was, you know, I imbibed all of this stuff as a kid, and it just so happened that my personality somehow, you know, jibed with the whole thing, and I really kind of fell in love with the subject. And also at that time, I was taken to the public library by my mom, who used to go and, like, take out loads of books, and I discovered the books of a particular author by the name of John Green. And John Green was, he lived in British Columbia. He was a former mayor and a resident of a town called Harrison Hot Springs. And he was I would say he's the first contemporary, Sasquatch researcher, journalistic investigator of eyewitness accounts. And he started publishing these books because he lived also in a hot spot. Harrison Hot Springs, by the way, is the community or the area in Canada where the name Sasquatch essentially originates from. the local, you know, First Nation community, the Stalis's First Nation, their name for the creature was Sesketz, which is wild man of the woods. And so back in 1929, there was a teacher living in the Harrison area named John Burns, and he was writing articles for Maclean's magazine. And he coined the name, he anglicized it to Sasquatch, and that's how it became basically popular. So John Green lived in this area. It's a place even still today of numerous reports. And so I just started reading these books at maybe like age 9 or 10 or, you know, 11, whenever I could really read adult books. And just you know, each chapter and each page was just story after story after story after story of like who saw what and what happened and these creatures and what they did and these screams and people getting attacked and just like it was, and you're reading this stuff and you're just like, it's nonfiction, right? But you're like, and I'm in the suburbs of Toronto in this kind of, you know, somewhat boring neighborhood where nothing really goes on, and there's all this action and excitement and adventure and mountains and creatures, and I'm just like, well, what am I doing here? This is like, I need to be out there checking this stuff out. So that was a really, really, I would say, you know, big influence in terms of my interest, and that got me really going into the subject. Wrong order of the slides. That's Steve Austin, the $6 million man, with the Sasquatch creature, played by Andre the Giant, the former wrestling star, who I guess they needed somebody who was huge and massive, and they found it. So, yeah, something definitely to YouTube whenever you have the chance. I'm also going to add, because I just noticed that I have a couple more points here, that after I reached, you know, early adulthood, I would say I kind of lost interest a little bit in the subject. So, I mean, you know, going to university, you're like, you know, hanging out with your friends, you're partying, all this stuff. You generally kind of like move on from the whole thing. So, but, you know, in an attempt to kind of fill you in on sort of what happened in between, you know, this time and my trips out there, I started to have these strange sorts of meetings with people who, you know, claim to have seen the creature, and like not like random strangers. There was a woman that I worked with in my late 20s at like a regular office job in Toronto, and she, you know, she claimed that I found out through somebody else, and then I went to talk to her about it. She claimed that on a drive up, I think 3 hours north of Toronto to a place called, you know, Collingwood, there's a bunch of forest up there. She and her boyfriend had claimed to have seen a creature across the road, and it was very, 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 very classical Sasquatch. Description, behavior, like even the way it walked, and she knew nothing about the subject. This was like right before Google and all the Sasquatch stuff got on the internet, and that's what really kind of struck me. I'm like, wow, this is, how could this be? Like, she doesn't know anything about it, but she described the creatures exactly. And then another friend of a friend, his family comes from Kashmir, and he said that like when his mom was a kid, the Yeti creatures had come down from the mountains and kidnapped these abducted goats and chickens because it was a really bad winter and stuff. And so just at every few years, I kept kind of coming across these stories. And so that kept the interest alive in a sense. And then, you know, ultimately I went back to the region or traveled to go, you know, for the article. And then that's what really kind of, you know, sparked it, I would say. And plaster casts of Sasquatch tracks, that photo that I took with some investigators in the Harrison Hot Springs area. So now comes the point in the story where I, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, the Sasquatch itself. I decided to do a 3-month trip in 2013, the next year, after that original magazine story. And the plan was to go to Vancouver Island, meet with a Sasquatch investigator named Dr. John Bindernagle, and then continue up to Bella Bella, and then up to Klemtu, and to Ocean Falls, and all these communities, and then see where I kind of stood with the whole thing, right? And just collect as much info as possible, talk to loads of people, and you know, travel, you know, between communities on float planes, on ferries. There's no roads up there, so it's all very much you have to kind of find your way around using the limited resources of the area. So What is the Sasquatch? The Sasquatch, according to the proponents who say that they exist, are these giant, tall, humanoid, bipedal, hairy, again, half man, half ape. That term is used a lot because people can't seem to agree whether it is more ape-like or more human-like, because it has human characteristics, and including intelligence and self-awareness. And they're very, very elusive, as we all know, because no one's found one yet. No, there is no body. There is no firm, indisputable evidence. The reports go back to, some of the early accounts of the explorers who were in that area. Even I would say out east, in terms of like the mountains of like the Alleghenies or the Adirondacks, you've got reports going back to the 1700s, 1800s, and then they become a little more numerous, referring to mountain devils or skookums. And they've got all these sort of like forest genies and man apes and that kind of thing. So there is a tradition, there is a history. And then when you speak to the First Nations, they'll also tell you that, yes, we have them in our storytelling traditions, and like depending on who you speak to in the area, like when I go to Bella Bella, they'll speak about the Thlathla or the Bukwas, and the Thlathla is basically this hairy wild woman of the forest who carries a basket on her back and abducts children. It's in the stories, but then you also have people who claim to see them, and it's both anecdote and storytelling, and similar creatures in Bella Coola and in Klemtu, different names a little bit. In Bella Coola, they call it the Sninik. Further south in Wikano, they refer to it as the Junaqua, and then or the Adzi for the little small woodsmen of the forest. So. And again, story figures, supernatural beings, nature stewards. I'm just going to jump ahead in the pictures here. That's just a shot of a boat trip that I took after my original trip to kind of go collect some further research. That's taken at a potlatch in Bella Bella, Heltsik First Nation. So that was the community that I spent the most time in investigating reports in, and returned there quite frequently. One of the more interesting aspects of the phenomenon involves these tracks, these footprints that people occasionally find. We know, or Sasquatch, the Sasquatch enthusiasts tell us that that it's a real creature because the tracks sink really deep into the ground. The toes tend to move in some cases between tracks. If it's going uphill, it will leave a partial print in the front. And then, you've got, in addition to these citizen investigators, like a small handful of scientists, anthropologists, who are like really, really attracted by the whole Bigfoot phenomenon. And so you've got these individuals who they study like primate locomotion or like bipedalism. So their specialty is how like humans and apes and our ancestors moved on their legs and feet. And so they suggest that this is a real creature because they can see in the tracks, which are often, cast in plaster of Paris, anatomical features and evidence of like bones and ligaments and joints and all said to be in the right spots. And even beyond that, they say that their claim is that, and I'm not a scientist, I can't really verify it, but they say that the alignment of all of these anatomical features is such that it would be like that for a foot trying to support something several hundred pounds. So like, you've got all of this, this sort of evidence from scientists that by some scientists, the wider community dismisses it. And then of course you have the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film, which was shot at a place called Bluff Creek in Northern California by these, two Sasquatch enthusiasts, essentially, who were investigating sightings and tracks in this area. And it's a short film. Most of you have seen it, if not all of you, at some point in your lives. Shot in '67, and it shows this female Sasquatch kind of running into the trees, and And again, the people pushing for the argument of Sasquatch will say that it's real because if you watch the film, you see these muscles move and like it walks in a certain way that humans can't walk. It's kind of got its knees bent and it brings its like legs up. And so this is the case for Sasquatch essentially, and including all of these reports by all these different people, and there are lots of them. So going back to that strange picture at the beginning, I just pulled this off of the internet because there's loads of them. Then you get the skeptics and the debunkers, and they're like, you know, they don't agree with any of this, and their whole take is, well, you know, where's the body, where's the hard evidence, why aren't there better photos from people? I mean, even the Patterson-Gimlin film doesn't really cut it for them, and no footage from trail cams, and they just point to these like really strange pictures that appear on the internet. They call them blob squatches of you know, people who claim to have seen them and kind of gotten a strange picture, and then they have to zoom in on it and say like, look, you can see its nose, you can see its mouth, and so the internet is kind of full of this stuff. And then, you know, furthermore, they say, well, maybe they're bears or you know, hoaxes, people in suits. We know there have been hoaxers. And so that's sort of the general lay of the land in terms of the for and the against arguments. I mean, there's a lot more kind of beyond that, but I mean, that's sort of more, it's just sort of extra detail. So my travels through the coast reflected a lot of these positions. So I didn't, you know, I'm not to give anything away in the story, but I just found that a lot of the for evidence was affirmed by eyewitnesses. A lot of the, you know, against arguments also affirmed by, you know, not everybody up there believes in them. So I got a lot of like both sides of the arguments, and so I was, you know, essentially left at an impasse during, you know, part of the halfway into the journey. And so how do you break the impasse? Like how do you try and kind of burst through these positions that are at loggerheads? And so I decided that in order to really try and unpack this as much as possible and understand it as much as possible, you really had to kind of get into human psychology. Like the whole phenomenon really boils down to human experience and the observer and the observed. And so I decided, well, okay, maybe I should try and, you know, see what I can find out from a psychological point of view. Because the best that I was able to do in terms of trying to explain it was, you know, if there is a Sasquatch, you know, could it be that we're dealing with a perfect, you know, storm of concealment? So you've got like an intelligent, you've got a self-aware nocturnal creature that, you know, society rejects and won't look further into, you know, because of, you know, academic hubris, media mockery, like the arrogance of officialdom and urban bias. Like perhaps we're not really acknowledging this phenomenon because we have a blind spot or there's an oversight in terms of what we kind of acknowledge to be real or not. And then on the other side, I could, you know, if there is no Sasquatch, how do you explain it? Like, how do you explain all of these reports? How do you account for the fact that people talk about, and sometimes, like, groups of adults together, like, a 30-second encounter where the creature is, like, 10 or 15 feet away from the people? And like, how does that even, you know, if it is a kind of a belief thing, if it is some kind of a problem of perception or a problem of memory, like, that doesn't happen to everybody everywhere, seemingly, right? So it really is a kind of conundrum and a kind of a dilemma, because however you decide to explain this thing, it would require a kind of remarkable explanation involving, you know, possibly things about the way we tick that we don't know about ourselves. And so that was the reason I decided to kind of go down that road. I'm just checking on my time. Okay. So, what did I uncover in the areas of psychology? And that's what I'm going to just focus on for a bit before I go into the reading. I read a whole bunch of books and it wasn't during the journey. I kind of framed it in the story where I begin to get into that whole discussion sort of partway through. But for a few years prior to, you know, finishing the book and before even the actual writing, I kind of dove into all of this, you know, psychological literature. And I discovered that through a number of authors, and you can find them in the bibliography, that our perception, we don't see reality as it actually exists. Okay. So, I mean, I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, I'm here, you've got the screen, and it seems all very simple, but apparently, you know, objective reality is composed of a blizzard of stimuli and energies and things. And so the human brain, in order to survive, to find mates, to find food, to find shelter, in order to simplify that reality, has to caricature it. And so our minds are almost always, always, always simplifying everything in its environment. And, you know, we're born with these pattern templates in our minds, right? And we acquire these visual templates as we get older. And so we see things by matching the templates in our mind to a similar pattern in the external environment. And so that's essentially how we see. And that's why people talk about if you don't know about a certain thing, it's harder to see it if you don't actually have the pattern. And so, but the way it works is that if the pattern you have and the thing that you are matching to on the outside are not exact but are similar, it will still match, but it will be a mismatch. And so I got into all this really interesting kind of research about this and, you know, found an interesting reason to understand that maybe people are making mistakes in seeing Sasquatches. But on the same foot, it's also can also explain why people don't see Sasquatches more often. Maybe that's why they are as elusive as they are, because maybe we don't have the pattern to see them, kind of thing. So that was one sort of road that I went down, and then also the area of beliefs. Our belief systems was a big part of the research, and I discovered similarly in other writing that, you know, we build our mental models of the world, our belief systems, less because of rational and logical beliefs or empirical reasons or even evidence. We tend to you know, support ideas or believe in things from hunches, from experiences, from upbringing, from conditioning, intuitions. And so we seldom change our minds, and we spend most of our time setting those worldviews in stone. But then when any kind of contradictory information or evidence or facts come our way, we tend to not change our minds. We ignore contradictory facts. And so things like, you know, cognitive dissonance, which is the inability to kind of hold two contradictory kind of pieces of information, or confabulation, where we have a reason for doing something, but we attribute other reasons for doing it, and, you know, willful blindness. We have all of these strange mechanisms, which are all designed to keep us stable and to allow us to more easily survive, but yet it gets in the way of us seeing reality as it actually is. And that explains why, you know, Sasquatch people perhaps are not really daunted by the fact that there is no body and that they themselves may not have seen a Sasquatch, and yet continue to believe in Sasquatches or continue to push Sasquatches. But by the same token, it also explains the behavior of, you know, debunkers and extreme skeptics, because they have their worldview as well, and so they are not really, really, really open-minded to the fact that this may be a real phenomenon. And so in a nutshell, I mean, I dove into all of these, into all of this research, and still, by the end of it, although it explained the behavior of Sasquatch proponents and enthusiasts, it also explained, you know, the thought processes of the people who opposed them. And so, again, I was left with this, you know, this impasse. And then I go off on another tangent to kind of explore another aspect of the phenomenon later in the book, and I won't spoil it for you. So, I mean, that's essentially kind of the dilemma that I was trying to crack in the whole journey. So I'm going to now read a section from the book. I'm just going to have a quick sip of water, and which it's not really related to the psychology so much. It's more of a a mirror image of the impasse as I experienced it on the ground in terms of the actual goings on. And so just to give you an idea of how kind of maddening it is to on one hand be seemingly so close to finding an answer, but then at the same time it being dispelled. So, and the section takes place in Bella Coola towards the end of my trip, and it refers a little bit to the geography, or you'll kind of get a sense of it. So, get my reading voice. I've reached the supposed ground zero of Bigfoot, the waking version of the lofty wilderness of my daydreams as a kid. It's hard to downplay the links and associations with Sasquatch here. Because of that, the idea of looking for the physical animal is tough to resist. For in a real sense, Bella Coola is Bigfoot. For Sasquatch enthusiasts, the town's very name, its contours of sound, evokes the creature's spirit. Whereas Bigfoots are said to appear occasionally in neighborhood communities, they are omnipresent here, neighboring communities. They are omnipresent here, constantly flitting between hidden recesses and blind spots. Residents allege the animals are bolder here than anywhere else on the coast, so much so that they'll walk through the front yard if need be. Reports span the length of the Bella Coola Valley and all adjoining creek and river systems. Ask around and you'll hear incidents of every variety involving howls, whoops, screams, loud crashing in the bush, and road crossings. Figures standing or crouching in the open at night, creeping into windows, banging on houses, throwing rocks, throwing sticks, and knocking on wood. And the putrid lingering odors and tracks in the mud or snow. Some reports are just weeks old, others have been circulating for more than half a century. The majority of encounter sites cluster in and around the town of Bella Coola and Four Mile Reserve, as well as on the highway and adjacent river running between the two communities. Drivers and cyclists and pedestrians on the two-lane road have reported seeing Sasquatches crossing it in both directions. Fishermen on the river have seen the animals on its shores. Nothing strikes me as particularly significant about this at first. The area around and between the two communities is the busy, more populated stretch of the valley. Residents here are mostly Newhawk, and Sasquatch awareness runs high. Whereas up the road in the non-native community of Hagensburg, as in Ocean Falls and Denny Island, there is far less belief in the creatures. And there are significantly fewer reports. Whether or not Sasquatches exist, it makes sense that there would be more reports in this thoroughfare zone than the rest of the valley. But when I look at Google Earth to get a better handle on the terrain, I notice something interesting. The entrances to four side valleys are located in the hot zone of reports. Three of those valleys are on the south side of the Bella Coola River, between 4 Mile and the ocean. The fourth is the Neklitskane Valley, facing them all on the north side. Each of these valleys is home to glacier-fed, salmon-bearing creeks and is a world unto itself. Their confluence is at the lower reaches of the Bella Coola River and is a nutrient-rich crossroads. Could the cluster of alleged Sasquatch activity in this area be indicative not just of human demographics, a cluster of belief, but also the proximity of those valleys to one another? In other words, could the higher number of reports be the result of real Bigfoots constantly moving among the valleys, crisscrossing back and forth between habitats and food sources? The Neklitskane, a narrow valley hemmed in by steep mountainsides and canyons, running 10 miles north from Bella Coola, strikes me as the most promising of the bunch. I bushwhacked its lower reaches on my previous visit alongside Clark Hans, who decades earlier had seen a Sasquatch on a ridge while duck hunting with his cousins. I share my ideas later that day in Four Mile with New Hawk Sasquatch investigator Lauren Mack. He concurs with my observations, adding that there are, quote, known routes between the valleys, unquote, on which the creatures travel. He shares with me his own treasure trove of plaster casts and stories outside his trailer. Keep in mind, he says afterwards, that we have at least two different creatures here according to our tradition. You have the Sninnik. It's tall and pale looking with clammy skin and thin patches of fur. It crouches in the bush with its knees coming up as high as its head. It makes whooping noises. Then you have the Books, which are darker and much smaller, child-sized. They're more tricky and dangerous. They're the Screamers. It's another reference to the little people of the Wiccano and the Bukwis, the little woodsmen of the Heltzik tradition. But neither of those, I say, accurately describes the classic Sasquatch, big, tall, often dark, hairy, the creature most often described. Those Sasquatches are hybrids, he says. There are other beings in our tradition, too. As I get to know the locals' discussions of this sort continue, culminating in a growing feeling again that the creatures, whatever their size, whatever their color or shape, whatever their nomenclature, likely exist. But tempering those stories in my discussions is Peter Mattson, known affectionately to his friends and acquaintances as the Swede. Mattson is an eccentric emigre ski bum from Europe who runs the Tweedsmuir Park Lodge and its heli-skiing operation at the head of the valley. In all the years I've been here, we've never seen a trace of them, he says in his cut-and-dried Scandinavian accent. And with all the flying that we do, especially taking our backcountry skiers and snowboarders over the mountains in the winter, you'd think we'd have seen tracks in the snow by now. But we haven't. Ever? Never. Not one track? He shakes his head. Not a track, not a toe print, not even a hair. And that's the end of that section. So as you can see, or as you can hear, a lot of back and forth, endless back and forth on the subject. And that's the way the trip unfolded up until the end. And I won't spoil the end, but that's a little bit of a taste of my book and my trip. And the real fun is answering questions, I think, too. So why don't we, if you've got anything to ask, I can fill in blanks. Right. So the theory that has been forwarded for a very long time by the same scientists who tell you about all of these anatomical things in the tracks is that the Sasquatch is possibly or probably related to or descended from an ancient giant ape that went extinct 500 million years ago or 500,000 years ago called Gigantopithecus. But nowadays, as the Sasquatch researchers get much more, they've got a lot more information and have a lot more theories now because the field has moved forward in their words so far. They say that, well, no, it can't be Gigantopithecus because the Sasquatch is human-like. It like thinks, it like calculates, it is self-aware. Like they'll find a trackway in the spring where there's patches of snow, and they'll claim that the Sasquatch, as it was running away from the witnesses, like went around the patches of snow to avoid leaving track. Like, so there is this kind of notion that they're more human than ape. So, but nobody actually knows. You can't know with any certainty. We know that there were other, you know, hominoid primate types that had co-evolved with us in parallel. We killed many of them and the others have died out, and so the speculation is this one managed to survive by hiding. So, hi. Mm-hmm. So if when you visit all of the communities, they will tell you that there is not just one, as I'd read in the segment there, not one type of primate. There's different species, and one of them is like they call them the little people, which is a kind of a term that is used in a lot of places to kind of, you know, to talk about, you know, elven, fairy. Like, I mean, it applies in a lot of other places. And so they insist that those smaller creatures are not juvenile Sasquatches, that they are adult, fully grown, you know, little Sasquatches. And so I think they're considered to be tricky and manipulative and kind of unruly and uncontrollable. The only thing that I can think of is, I mean, I don't know why that would be the case, unless maybe they're seeing children of Sasquatches, and children are kind of like, you know, they are misbehaving or something. That's as far as my thinking goes on it. But there is even a scene in the book where I come across tracks that we find on a, you know, muddy shoreline of a remote lake that are like really small, but they're like really funny looking. And that was, there was a lot of talk that week that those were, you know, little Sasquatches that had left those. Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I returned in 2013, the next year, no one had really remembered me the year before, because it was such a short trip, and I hadn't met any of the key people that I wanted to meet for the book. But they're small communities, they're remote, they're largely indigenous, and at the time there was a lot of conflict with the energy companies, I guess, in Alberta and Enbridge, and attempts to build pipelines. I mean, that's still ongoing now, but and tankers and the whole thing. And so I think everyone who came into the community, they saw as a potential, you know, informer or spy or someone coming to kind of watch them, because there's a lot of activism in the communities. They're very, 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 very anti, you know, industry, large scale, let's say, extractive industry kind of and development on that level. So on one hand, I think there was a group of people who, you know, they saw me walking around with my notebook, and like I would, you know, go to the pub and I would talk to people and I would be like writing stuff down. And so it came to a head at one point where I got called into the band office and got talked to and everything. There's a whole scene around that, and in part because, I don't know which direction I have to go for the picture, I think it's maybe this way. I attended one of the potlatches and I was taking some photographs, and so that also caused a bit of a furor, but I mean, it got smoothed over in the end. So yeah, I mean, a really big part of the journey, and which I incorporated into the book as a sub-narrative, was this whole, how does this, you know, city guy, this Toronto guy, this stranger, find acceptance in a community which has had so many difficulties with outsiders? And that was across the board, mostly in Bella Bella, but and also not even just politically. Like, also, when you go to ask somebody about their Sasquatch report, it's like a really personal thing, you know. So not just because they're sort of putting themselves on the line in terms of ridicule, but also some people have got really complex beliefs about the Sasquatch, that it's a supernatural being, or that they've come across, it's almost a kind of a deity or a spirit. And so it's like any of us sharing our deeper religious beliefs with other strangers. Hey. Yeah. No, and I would say the majority, if not almost all of the people who live in these communities, who are on board with the existence of the creatures, they don't really kind of see it as a big deal. Like, so they don't go looking for them. They don't go chasing after them. They kind of, it's case by case, but depending on the person, they kind of look down a little bit on those who go in pursuit of them. I mean, in my case, they knew it was for a book, but even then I was kind of getting comments like, you know, you're not going to find it, don't bother chasing it, and you know, like you know, you're going to endanger them. And it's more the scientists, I find, and the the investigators, the citizen investigators who are all kind of in pursuit of this it's kind of a holy grail, and that's why you get all of the infighting in the Sasquatch community so much, is because people are hiding information from other people and people are trying to like debunk the other people's findings and so on. But yes, I think that if the creatures are shown to exist beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's not going to help them, right? It's not going to do them any good, even though the Sasquatch researchers use that as an excuse for their research. We have to like convince the world because we have to like protect them. But I mean, if we're not able to protect ourselves and all the other creatures and all the ecosystems, then why are we going to do it just for this ape? I mean, apes are getting shot in Africa, right? So I don't know. I mean, that's my take on it. So, hey. Yeah. Well, I don't think they are objectively on equal footing. I think what I was trying to say more is that in terms of my story and in terms of my narrative as this guy who grew up with these childhood stories and who is influenced, has been influenced by them emotionally and on one level wants to believe, that was the push and pull that was happening in my own mind, being a little bit biased towards the creatures, I would say. But I mean, I agree. I think that from a purely objective stance, they're not necessarily equal. I think as they're given different value based on what your rationale is, with each explanation, then it will, perhaps the pro Sasquatch can be elevated, but that would be in one's own mind. So yes, I agree. I agree for sure. So and was it you who had said that you knew someone who'd seen one? Are you from there? Okay, I was just there actually, 3 weeks ago. Yeah, yeah. And did he tell you what happened exactly, or what was the? Right, okay. And how did you? I mean, what was your reaction to the story? I mean, was he a friend of yours, or? Okay, yeah, okay, right, yeah. Yeah, lots of bears up there. Interesting. And there was someone else. Was it you who said you've? Yeah, yeah. And I was saying this at the previous talk this morning that, I mean, those who are interested in this subject in a really serious way, like they're very obsessional, like straight line, like you get sucked in, right? I mean, even working on this book, when you hear stories, you don't know if they're true or not, but you just want to hear more and more of them. There's almost an addictive quality to it because you just get thrown into a trance because some of the stories are so bizarre or remarkable. And when you're in those sorts of, environments, right, with these huge mist-covered, intact forests, it's almost fairy tale-like, right? It becomes easier to see that these things, or it becomes easier to believe that they may exist, right? So, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's kind of good that the book's done and sort of ready to. I mean, you could just go on forever, right? You can just keep looking and keep looking and keep looking. And so, where's Easterville? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No. I worked. I was at CB. I was doing a CBC radio gig back in 2001. And I worked on an interview with a woman who lived in a place called, Bruce, tell you the name of the place? Fisher Branch. Yeah. And she was the local Sasquatch investigator in that area, and apparently a whole bunch of her friends and some of her relatives and a lot of hunters and, backcountry kind of people had claimed to see them. So, I knew that there's a history of reports there too. So, but no, I don't know much about. Has there been anything up there recently? Or okay, yeah, yeah.